From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for that support. We don't take you for granted. We value you highly. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, the Baha'i 19-day fast continues until March 20th, and the 5th is Orthodox Christian Sunday. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, I'm saddened to note the loss of a formidable competitor. After almost 20 years of distinctive coverage of religion on mainstream television, the award-winning weekly program Religion and Ethics News Weekly has come to an end. I want to take this opportunity to thank my friend Kim Lawton, that show's managing editor and correspondent, for her decades of vitally important work, and to wish her all the best in the future. In a horrific attack on the constitutional right to freedom of speech and assembly, the number of states within Republican legislatures exploring various attempts to curtail protests is up to 18, ranging from reclassifying protest acts as felony crimes to decriminalizing a driver hitting protesters if they happen to be on a public street, to seizing the assets of protest organizers. These are actions that call for universal protests while we can still do that. And earlier this week, the President of the United States finally acknowledged the terrifying weeks-long series of bomb threats phoned in to Jewish organizations nationwide, as well as vandalism of Jewish cemeteries during his first address to a joint session of Congress. Overshadowing his strong words on Tuesday night, however, were reports of both the president and one of his nominees suggesting that those attacks could be false flag initiatives designed to trump up sympathy for the victims. Terrible. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
The fire broke out early last Saturday at the Victoria Islamic Center, burning it to the ground. But the community in Texas has rallied around this group, and one synagogue and at least four churches have offered space where their Muslim neighbors can worship.
Jewish cemetery was vandalized. Some Muslims decided to launch a fundraiser to repair the headstones.
It's heartening to see members of different religious groups stand together in the face of hate, discrimination, or violence. It's inspiring to see faith leaders stand together to oppose government policies they see as immoral and un-American. But it's a lot harder to get an accurate estimate of the width and breadth of what could qualify as interfaith activism and organizing. A comprehensive new report titled Interfaith Journeys, An Exploration of History, Ideas, and Future Directions has just been published by the World Faith Development Dialogue, and I look forward to welcoming the author, Catherine Marshall, to this week's show.
It's a big topic. It's all academic suicide. If I wanted to be an academic, you wouldn't write a book called How Change Happens, but I'm trying to communicate with a wider group of people.
We've recently witnessed what can happen when many people hunger for change, yet reach for it in an uncritical and undisciplined way. I'm talking about the national election, of course, but affecting change for the better is profoundly challenging in any arena. An intriguing book addressing this challenge titled Simply How Change Happens appeared recently from Oxford University Press, and I'm looking forward to talking with the author, Dr. Duncan Green, on this week's show. But first...
And Ryan is looking down right now. You know that. And he's very happy because I think he just broke a record.
So just like everything else having to do with a new administration, the joint session of Congress address this week seemed to land very differently with supporters and opponents. It's also worrisome that whichever of those groups you fall into, it's likely that most of the conversations you had after the speech were with people who tend to agree with your point of view. Multiply that by the national population, and you've got a serious disconnect between two halves of America. A step towards understanding how many of our neighbors hold diametrically opposing points of view can be taken with some reliable facts and figures. And joining me right now is Dr. Robert P. Jones, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. Robbie, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me back, Welton.
It feels like a real minefield. The minute you start talking about how polarized the nation is right now, do the numbers that you have bear out that level of divisiveness?
Yeah, you know, it's real. So, you know, what people are feeling and seeing in their neighbors and friends and on Facebook, and it's real, and it's different than it was in the past. Part of the deal, I think, is that President Trump's unique profile, I mean, he is still setting records for being the least popular incoming president in the country. So, like, just for example, you know, when George W. Bush came into office in 2001, despite the fact that that was actually a very contentious election that was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court along party lines of judges being appointed by the Democrats and Republicans, so very, very contentious. And yet he walked into office with a 67% favorable rating among the American people. So a lot of Democrats had a favorable view of him. Contrast that with President Trump, who only has a 43% favorable rating. So he's gotten virtually no crossover from the other side of the aisles. And it's almost perfect symmetry. You know, we have 87% of Republicans reporting a favorable view of Trump, and 83% of Democrats expressing a negative view. You don't get much more symmetrical than that.
PRRI has released some very interesting findings that are certainly compelling. Talk, if you will, about the disconnect between how Americans see the president's relationship with the Constitution and whether they think there ought to be consequences, please.
Yeah, so we asked because there had already been calls for impeachment and accusations that the president had violated the Constitution. So we decided we would just ask about this and what the American people thought. So we asked it two different ways. One was, do you think that President Trump has acted in a way that violates the U.S. Constitution, or don't you think so? Americans are evenly divided on that question. 47% say yes, he's acted in ways that violate the Constitution. 46%. Say he has not. But again, you know, it's basically 8 in 10 Democrats saying that he has and about 8 in 10 Republicans saying that he hasn't on the other side. We also asked directly about impeachment. Here it's interesting. We found only about 3 in 10. So just despite the fact that about half the country thinks that he's acted in ways that violated the Constitution, only 3 in 10 Americans say at this point they think he should be impeached. That level is actually not that different than levels for Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and his about 30% of the country at times during their presidency thought that they should be impeached. So, you know, there's this clear sense that maybe he's done some things wrong, but I think there's enough people saying, you know, maybe, well, let's wait and see before we pull the impeachment lever. But still, I mean, these numbers I think would be troubling for Trump, and it also certainly, you know, points to just how differently partisans are reading this presidency.
Robbie, is there a bottom line that's pretty much going to stay the same among supporters of Trump?
Well, I mean, one of the things that is striking to me is that, you know, what we see, if you look over the long period of time with partisanship, I mean, one of the problems we're dealing with is that partisanship now has become part of people's like core identity in ways that it really wasn't a few decades ago. So this is a great question that Stanford University asked in the 1960s, and they asked people, Democrats and Republicans, how upset they would be if their son or their daughter married someone from the opposite political party. And only like 4% of Republicans and 5% of Democrats said that they'd be very upset back in the 1960s. The question got asked again during Barack Obama's presidency, and by the middle of his presidency, those numbers had jumped to 33% of Democrats and 49% of Republicans saying that they would be very upset if their son or daughter married someone of the opposite political party. And what that basically says, you know, is that it used to be the case that partisanship was something that people took to the ballot box with them. But today, really, what we're seeing is partisanship is something that people are taking to bed with them.
So what about the level of support for the ban on Muslims?
When we asked about this during the campaign season, only about 4 in 10 Americans supported it. Support has actually dropped 5 points. It's down to 35%, so only a little more than a third of Americans actually support this policy. But it's another sign of the Trump administration not really pushing something that has a broad mandate behind it. But the key here is that two-thirds of Republicans support this policy, but only 10% of Democrats do. But, you know, it's delivering a policy to the base. And I think that's one of the, to me, one of the best ways of kind of understanding the way Trump is conceiving of his presidency is that it's less about being president to the whole country. At least, you know, by my lights, the signals he's sending are that he's less concerned about bringing people together and, you know, offering an olive branch to the other side, and more about just delivering to the less than half of Americans who actually voted for him. And, you know, what that means is that he's really is seeing the presidency more along the lines of a kind of hostile corporate takeover than someone who won a Democratic election in a divided country.
Robbie, obviously the biggest division is along party lines, but I'm interested in what your numbers show are the other splits among our countrymen and women.
Well, I mean, the religious divides, as they were in the election, are still pretty interesting here. You and I have talked about this before, but I mean, really since the Civil Rights Movement, where the Democratic Party became kind of identified as the party of civil rights, where white Christians, particularly in the South, then switched parties to be Republicans, that pattern has been with us, and you can see it on a lot of these issues. So, you know, at the ballot box, it was essentially white Christian voters, particularly white evangelical voters, supporting Trump, and non-white Christian voters and kind of everyone else, non-Christian religious people, religiously unaffiliated people supporting the Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. And we see those same divides. So like on the issue that we were just talking about on the temporary travel ban for Muslims, the only group that's in support of this are white evangelical Protestants, which was the group who voted 81% for Donald Trump in the elections. And so it really is this base group, again, that Trump is, I think, delivering. So today, 61% of white evangelical Protestants support temporarily banning Muslims from other countries. Among white Catholics, it's actually dropped to 44%. It's actually dropped among white mainline Protestants. It's down at 39%. And among non-white Protestants, so African-American Protestants, Latino Catholics, it's only 27%. And what's also remarkable is that the only group in the religious landscape that has moved in a more positive direction on this issue is white evangelical Protestants. And we're kind of seeing that pattern that white evangelicals are essentially aligning their political priorities with the new president.
A lot of us are seeing the current political situation as a last gasp effort to somehow hang on to the kind of America that you wrote about in your book, the end of white Christian America.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been getting a lot of emails saying, you want to put an asterisk on the end of that book title? You know, the end of white Christian America, maybe we're not quite there. Fair enough, I mean, because we're seeing, I think, some big consequences. But I think here's the thing, is that, you know, as I continue to look at the data and the trends, you know, we are still seeing the trends moving only in one direction. That is, the country becoming more diverse, less white, less Christian, and more religiously and ethnically diverse. Like, those are the ongoing trends, and nothing in this election really has changed that. I mean, what we're seeing, though, I think is, I think what the Trump administration really is going to do, and we're seeing a lot of the evidence of this, is kind of prop up by force, you know, a kind of bulwark against the broader trends in the culture. But, you know, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, will we look back and see this election as the resurrection of white Christian America? I don't think so. You know, I think what we'll see is this election really is the last gasp or a kind of death rattle of that world as it tries to hang on to power as, you know, all the cultural winds are blowing the other direction. It's a little hard to see right now, I think, given just the vast changes. But I guess one other thing I'd say is it's really important to remember, though, I mean, this election came down to a little over 77,000 votes across three states. That's what the Electoral College victory depended upon. So it was razor, razor thin. And, you know, it in many ways, I think, was kind of a rabbit out of a hat that cuts against the grain of the longer trends, none of which have changed.
Dr. Robert P. Jones is CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. A wealth of insights is available on the Institute website at prri.org. Robbie, I really wanted to talk with you, so thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much, Welton. Always happy to be here.
Perhaps it's the fact that the world seems to have been changing recently at an almost unimaginable rate. But when I saw the title of Duncan Green's new book, How Change Happens, I was immediately intrigued. And I'm happy to be able to welcome the author to State of Belief Radio. Duncan Green joins us from England via Skype. Dr. Green, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Duncan, are most people interested in change, or do they fear change, and does that phenomena differ among cultures?
Great question. I mean, I think the book's argument is that whether you fear it or whether you want it, it's coming anyway, and we need to understand it. I don't like change that much. You know, I shop in the same stores, and I buy the same stuff, and it drives my wife crazy. So it's quite funny that I ended up writing a book about change, but it just became so apparent when I was traveling around the world for Oxfam that I was seeing very fast change in communities in different ways, in countries, and I just wanted to try and understand it as a phenomenon. I think there are things to fear about change. So, yeah, there is a real attraction to continuity, but clearly when things are bad, you want stuff to change, and so we need to get better at understanding it and then trying to either stop bad stuff happening or encourage good stuff to change.
Yeah, you write about the power to affect changes being dependent on people's self-confidence and belief that they can affect change. How does that happen?
So when people say power, they usually mean, or they often mean, formal power. Who's got control over the guns? Who's got control over the legislation? Who makes the decisions in government or in, you know, in the private sector? I think power is much more all-pervasive than that. Power is like this kind of force field which permeates society. And often another way to think about change is that we have power which is really unevenly distributed and we're trying to balance it up a bit. So when you think about power like that, you start to think about different kinds of power. And one of the key kinds of power, I think, is power within. It's when people get a sense of their rights, of their dignity, and women say, he has no right to beat me anymore, or people suddenly start thinking that, you know, the police guy has no right to demand a bribe, and they start to stand up and be counted, and then all these other more formal processes can kick off. But often we find at Oxfam that unless you work on that inner power, that sense of dignity and rights and self-confidence, the rest doesn't happen. So it's kind of linking up that internal personal world to the external political world, if you like, seems to be a really important step.
One of the lines that in your book that just jumped out at me is this one: change is the killing of fear. How so?
If you look at people who do really brave, crazy stuff, if you look at the Rosa Parkses and the Martin Luther Kings, if you look at the Egyptian protesters in Tahrir Square in 2011, it's really scary to get out and do something. If you've always assumed that your views don't count, it's really scary to stand up and say something. There's a lot of fear about speaking to someone in a position of power. What if I look stupid? What if they laugh at me? So I think this inner confidence is absolutely essential for people to take those risks.
My guest is Dr. Duncan Green, author of the new book, How Change Happens. I was really impressed by your observations on the relationship between faith, religion, and change. I'd like you to talk about that, the role of faith or religion in change, and also say something about your observation of how much people of faith hold in common.
I feel slightly awkward at this point because I think I should probably confess at some point that I'm not a person of faith. But I have worked with people of faith for many years, especially in Latin America, and acquired a sort of profound affection and awe for them. I used to work at the Catholic Aid Agency in the UK, and we had these extraordinary nuns who were getting arrested all the time. Meetings were cancelled because they'd chained themselves to the railings outside the Ministry of Defence, and so they'd been arrested again, and Sister Pat couldn't come, and all this. And it was just, it was extraordinary. So I think with that and with the sort of liberation theology movements in Latin America and so on, I've come to see that very, very close relationship between a faith in a deeper and better world, a faith in the essential decency of those around you, and a faith in a common purpose. And when you stand outside faith, as I do, and you look across the faiths, you do see an extraordinary amount in common. That golden rule of, I will treat people as I wish to be treated, the basic commitment to give to the poor and needy. You know, I was looking at the numbers for zakat. Any Muslim who's a good Muslim is supposed to give a 40th of their total wealth every year as charity. And if you add that up around the world, that comes to about 7 times more than all the global official aid in the world. You know, there's this huge amount of altruistic giving in different religions. And I just think it's impossible to understand social change without thinking what motivates people, and often it's faith.
Well, let's go to politics. You note that political parties are a relatively new but powerful factor in democracies. So what is the role of political parties in change? Or do you see the biggest changes right now as being bigger than political parties?
I think activists often make a big mistake and think political parties are irrelevant. When you look at change from a bit of a distance, what you see is there are moments of social organization, social mobilization, people in the streets, and there are big spikes of protest or big spikes of activity. But in between, political parties are this kind of cog which links up people and all the different demands and wishes in society and sort of channel those and sort of order them in a way that governments can understand. So I think actually engaging with political parties is essential if you want to bring about change. They act as a kind of filter and a sorting mechanism. Because if you think about society, everybody wants something different. There's different interest groups on a million different issues. How is a government supposed to listen or respond? Well, political parties is one of the ways to make sense of all that.
In the United States right now, we're in the middle of a major debate on the value and the moral credibility of media. You talk in the book about the role of media. How important are media in change? And how should we view the credibility and the value of media?
The media is changing incredibly fast in developing countries. In some ways, it's like where the changes are similar to the ones we're seeing in the US or in Europe, but they're a bit further ahead. So the fragmentation, the shock jocks, the telepopulists, they've all been out there for decades in various countries in the developing world. But you've now got, added to that, the social media. And so what you get is enormous fragmentation. You get the filter bubbles and the echo chambers and everything else. And the question then becomes, so does the media just reinforce and amplify difference, or does it build bridges? Mm. And I think clearly it does both. And so I think the interesting bit is to get inside the media as a system and say which bits are building those bridges and supporting them. One of the things that's clear is just giving people information through the media is not enough. You've actually got to involve them in discussion, deliberation, that sort of public conversation, which Amartya Sen talks about. And then when you get that going, then you can actually achieve something. And I'll give you one nice example from our own work. In East Africa, we've organized a reality TV competition for female farmers, for women farmers. A national TV company goes and films a bunch of women farmers. They then describe them on television, show their work, and the audience vote. And it's gone viral. You know, the agriculture minister watches it in Tanzania, and it's changed the way people understand the role of women in agriculture, using the media to challenge stereotypes. And that's the kind of thing that gets me very excited and makes me feel very positive about the media.
Yeah. Duncan, you say that you have met extraordinary citizens activists around the world. What do those effective citizen activists have in common?
I think some of the best ones are really good at listening. You know, you expect leaders to talk, and they all talk. But the ones who can actually listen and understand where people are coming from are invaluable. And I get very frustrated when I see activists who are just stuck on transmit and never receive. So that's one thing I've seen, I think. Mm-hmm. I think another one is a conscious effort to check who's not in the room, who's not in the conversation, is really important. Yeah, Robert Chambers, one of my favorite authors, talks about always wondering in a conversation who is the upper and who is the lower in this conversation, because that will affect what is said and what is not said. And I think that sort of self-awareness of your own role and the role of the people in the room and the role of the people not in the room keeps you honest, keeps you sort of aware of the world.
You gave some very good counsel for activists and other change makers, and I wish you'd just do a very brief version of that, of talking with our listeners about activism and making change and the counsel you give to people trying to do that.
Well, this came out of my favorite guinea pig, who's my son, who's a community organizer in South London. And I showed him the book and he read it and he said, "That's great, but you've got to boil it down to two slides of a PowerPoint or no one will remember it." And I was kind of distraught because I just finished the book. I thought, "Oh no, I've got to do this." But I gave it a go. And I think what I focused on was the state of mind of an effective activist and the kinds of questions they should be asking. And the state of mind, I think, has got to be very, very curious. You know, we're in these complex, fast-changing systems. And it's fatal if you just think, I just need to know enough to design my campaign or to do my project. You've got to be really interested in the world and how it's changing and what's new and the gossip and all that. So I think that's one part of it. Another part, I think, is if the world is this complex, ever-changing system, you're never going to actually understand everything. You're never going to be able to predict what is going to be changing around you. And your solutions may well be wrong for any given problem. So you need a kind of as a rational humility about the limitations of what you can know about the system that you're trying to influence. But at the same time, to be an activist, you need to be confident, get out there, speak truth to power, stick it to the man. And it's very hard to ride those two horses at once, the position of confidence and assertiveness and of humility and ambiguity. But I think there's no choice. It's a kind of cognitive dissonance, a sort of very difficult thing to do. But I don't see the option. You know, you have to try and keep those two things in your mind, even if it hurts. I think you have to be aware of power. And I think you have to have in mind that whatever you start off doing is not going to be what you end up doing. Yeah. So how good are you at accepting you've made mistakes, at changing direction, at listening to other people's advice and saying, fine. You know, so one of the things I do with all my books is I publish the draft. And yeah, some people find that very, very scary. You know, what if you've said something stupid? Well, I'd much rather people spotted that before it's published. So, you know, I've got into the habit of publishing everything in draft because you get a better end result. But that means you have to have a acceptance of criticism and feedback.
How did writing this book on change change you?
I think it made me much more relaxed about being confused. So you know, there's always a tendency to want to know what's the right answer on any given question, to think really hard and you know, narrow down the options and then say, right, this is it, this is my thing. And writing the book has made me really comfortable with that Alice in Wonderland thing of, you know, believing seven contradictory things before breakfast. And somehow doing that at the same time as moving forward and at the same time as coming out with a story about how the world can get better. So I think it was good therapy for me, at least. I don't know if anyone else will find it like that. But.
Well, I have to tell you, I found it very, very helpful. Dr. Duncan Green is Oxfam Great Britain's Senior Strategic Advisor. He also teaches on international development at the London School of Economics, where he is a professor in practice. His books include From Poverty to Power, How Active Citizens and Effective States Can Change the World. The latest is titled How Change Happens. Dr. Green, great thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
The term interfaith activism means different things to different people. The phrase will evoke different images for followers of different faiths and of no faith. There are also differing opinions about the best way to pursue these varying ideals. An ambitious attempt to circumscribe these broad but critically important ideas appeared last month in the form of a report mapping the complex landscape of interreligious engagement. It's titled Interfaith Journeys, An Exploration of History, Ideas, and Future Directions. The author is Dr. Catherine Marshall, Executive Director of the World Faith Development Dialogue and Senior Fellow at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. I know of no one who can talk about this issue better than Catherine Marshall. Catherine, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, and very good to talk to you.
This report covers a tremendous amount of ground. Would you talk about what you set out to achieve when you began putting this together?
One of the challenges that I have found in working with so many different religious communities, but also working on global challenges like the Sustainable Development Goals or peace or water or sanitation, is that there are countless organizations that really know very little about what others are doing. Mm-hmm. And so a first objective was to try to map this the territory so that at a minimum, there's a better awareness of what other groups are doing. We're always asking the question for any global issue or any local issue, what does religion have to do with it? Why does that matter? And how does that translate into policy and action? And so that, in a sense, was the driving question behind this.
Catherine, what are some of the most noteworthy findings in the report?
Well, I think one of the things that, in a sense, surprised me or that I had not quite realized fully was how rarely an issue is only about religious beliefs or religious practices or religious institutions. Any conflict, that's an obvious example, but also any challenge, whether it's healthcare in the United States or dealing with refugee issues or dealing with sanitation involves religious issues, but also involves many others. So that, I think, is one. A second finding or conclusion is how much disagreement and theories there are that affect how people see dialogue. In other words, for some people, dialogue is about ideas. It's about listening. It's about understanding others. Whereas there's a not insignificant community that views dialogue as blah, blah, mm-hmm. just kumbaya talk without being willing to get into the messy world of action. So you have a whole other sort of set of approaches and philosophies that start from common action and move from there towards better understanding. And I think a third finding, which may not surprise you that this is one that has struck me, is that in many ways people talking from very different religious traditions may find it easier to find common ground, whether they're Muslims and Christians or Shia and Sunni or evangelicals and Catholics. If they get to know each other and actually engage in a conversation, that may be an easier bridge to cross than trying to talk with economists, for example, or people who come from a much more secular perspective. So we talk about interfaith or interreligious, which would be among different communities. We talk about intrafaith, which is the issue of the passionate family disagreements within traditions. But then you have the very large issue of people who approach the world from a religious perspective, primarily. Everyone has a religious perspective of some kind, but people whose primary focus is religion, and for them to try to communicate with people from a secular world or for people from a secular perspective who are instinctively nervous about dealing with religion, trying to understand a religious perspective, I think that's an even more challenging and even more important area for where we need to focus.
Are there common obstacles to having real dialogue across religious boundaries that you see both in the United States and you see them abroad as well?
My own view is that our worst enemy is ignorance. In other words, and there is a lot of evidence that when people know each other and have direct knowledge of people from a very different background, that most people are very open to that. But I think you're getting at a much more complex issue, which is when someone has a religious set of beliefs or a religious worldview which they hold to deeply and passionately and which excludes others. It's not a broad view across the society, though it is accentuated when people are afraid or when they feel threatened that they will cling more tightly either to identities or beliefs. But my general sense from talking to so many people and reading so many commentaries is that the positive, the openness, is really a much more common feature of our country and our society.
I'm interested in your thoughts related to recent grassroots connections across lines of religion. I'm talking about Jewish circles of protection around threatened mosques or Muslims working to repair vandalized Jewish cemeteries and heartwarming efforts like that. Is this step toward each other something beyond what we've seen in the past?
I think it probably is more than we've seen before. In other words, I think that people who might never have made the effort to reach out to their neighbors maybe are being brought in because it's more visible and there's more publicity around it. On the other hand, I also suspect that there have been many efforts at community levels in the past that weren't documented, that we don't know. So this is part of a mapping exercise. I was looking not very long ago at the question of how American communities, religious communities especially, are looking at the challenges of hunger, of people who are hungry. And the numbers of soup kitchens which have interreligious membership and participation and volunteers is extraordinary. There are dozens in large cities. It still is not addressing fully the problem of people who are marginalized and suffering in our society. But it's far more than anyone has documented or than I think is recognized. So on the one hand, yes, we're seeing a heartening willingness of people to try to come together as to protect. But I think that it is the core of what our society is about. It is part of our founding values. So I think that if we recognize that and respect it and honor it more, we will see more, and therefore we'll have more to build on.
Governments are often successful in pursuing political goals, using and manipulating religious beliefs. How successful have religious communities been in nudging governments toward reflecting interreligious values and priorities?
Every government is a bit different on this. And if you actually look at just the constitutions, not to speak of sort of daily practice in all of the countries of the world, each one of them has their own approaches and relationships with the religious institutions that exist. So what I'm doing is trying not to generalize too much. What I do think is that we lived in a world where many, particularly in Europe and North America and in Australia and New Zealand and other parts of the world, had sort of assumed that religion became private, that it had really very little to do with the public space, except perhaps as some indication that someone had thought about ethical issues and had some ethical convictions. But I think that we really, since the early 80s particularly, the myth that religion would decline in importance with modernization has been pretty well killed. It's been proven to be really quite false. And therefore, many public figures, many government institutions have had to deal with the reality of religious institutions, but also religious convictions and beliefs. So there have been a lot of efforts, and you've been involved in many of them, as have I, to try to go a step beyond this awareness that religion is important still, to what does that really mean in terms of the way that we manage plural societies? How do we manage the fact that people hold quite different views very passionately, but also that there's an enormous infrastructure of religious schools and health centers and involvement in housing, involvement in dealing with the most vulnerable? So I think that we're at a stage now of increasing sensitivity and increasing awareness, but not necessarily with the knowledge tools and the policy tools that we need to translate that into good policy.
Talk a little bit about the work that you're doing with World Faith Development Dialogue and how our listeners could support that work.
Well, the World Faith Development Dialogue was born in a very improbable place, which was at the World Bank when Jim Wolfensohn, the president, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, George Carey, were disappointed and troubled by the levels of tension between religious communities and the development institutions about debt issues, about environment issues, about structural adjustment, about gender issues, relations between men and women. And so they started a dialogue process back in 1999, and that's the World Faith Development Dialogue, which I now am leading and have been leading for some time. We sit at Georgetown University. We're small, but we punch above our weight. And we're very focused on trying to answer the tough questions that we were discussing today. You know, what does it really mean to take religion seriously for Kenya, for Bangladesh, for Habitat for Humanity, for the refugee challenge, which is so much on our minds at the moment? And we have a wonderful website with all kinds of material. We've explored corruption issues, housing, water, sanitation, maternal health, female genital cutting, refugee problems in Kenya. And we welcome very much any questions, any ideas of what we should do next, and any other support.
And what is that website?
It is Berkeley Center, Berkeley Center, C-E-N-T-E-R, that's one word, period, georgetown.edu/WFDD.
Thank you, because I think some of our listeners are going to want to know more about this, and they will benefit from what you have on that website, which is so good. Catherine Marshall.
Welcome any ideas.
Catherine Marshall is Executive Director of the World Faith Development Dialogue and Senior Fellow at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. She's the author of a substantive new report from the WFDD titled Interfaith Journeys, An Exploration of History, Ideas, and Future Directions. Catherine, this project is so valuable, and particularly right now. I have always respected the massive amount of work that you do in this area. I'm grateful for that, and I really thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Before we go, it's coming up fast. The 2017 Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards ceremony in Washington, D.C. We'll be celebrating the lifetime of work journalist Diane Rehm has shared with her listeners in Washington, D.C. and around the country. We'll also be honoring attorney, constitutional advocate, and Gold Star dad Keyser Khan. The reception and awards ceremony is Tuesday, April 4th at the Mitchell Gold Bob Williams Downtown Washington location. In addition to honoring two exemplary Americans, this is also an important fundraiser for Interfaith Alliance. Complete details are available at interfaithalliance.org. That date again, April 4, 2017, in Washington, D.C. I hope to see you there. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We're counting on you now more than ever. And quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful today, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archives, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Our faithful creative producer is Ray Kirstein. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.